Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this afternoon from a snowy, wintry day here in West Kelowna, British Columbia. In today's program, we continue our series on the conservation of humanity, dissecting the Chinese coronavirus, the massive and unwarranted overreaction perpetrated by governments around the world, and the tremendous ramification these restrictions have had on life and liberty. I'm honored to host some frontline healthcare warriors today. Joining us for this episode, we have nurses Christine Nagel, Nicole Sirotek, Sarah Chijunian, and Erin Marie, Catherine Story, and Alex Flett, all from Global Frontline Nurses. Their mission is to unite nurses so that their collective voices can be heard loudly against the draconian COVID measures presently in place and to uphold their oaths. Nurses, it's a great pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for your time and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very well. We got a good panel here. So maybe if we can start, if everybody could just give me a brief history, brief introduction on yourselves, and then we'll get into the meat of the interview. Let's start with you, Kirsten.
Hi. So I'm Kirsten Nagel. I've been a nurse for 14 years now, primarily in the neonatal intensive care unit with a background in pediatrics as well. And I also went back to school to become a registered holistic nutritionist. So I have a background in both conventional medicine as well as more holistic approach.
Excellent. Sarah?
Oh, hi. My name is Sarah. I've been a nurse since 2004. I've worked in a nursing home for most of my career and also in the community, mostly with kids. And also for me, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia in 2017, which made me look into alternative ways to heal and made me realize that a lot of my somatic illness came from trauma. And, you know, I had to work on my mental health. So I'm big on that. I became a facilitator, and I also started my own organization called Lighting Up Dark Corners to empower survivors. So for me, mental health is also big, and those are the two main things that I speak about when it comes to the lockdowns.
Very good. And of course, the mental health issue of the lockdowns is an extremely important portion of the equation there. Nicole? Oh, we got to get her unmuted first.
There we go.
There we go. Nicole, you're unmuted now.
Thanks. So my name is Nicole Sirotek, and unfortunately, many people know me from a foul-mouthed, snotty-nosed viral video back in May, where I went to NYC in May 2020 to help fight the COVID pandemic. And what I experienced was a lot of gross negligence and medical mismanagement. And I was like begging for help because places like, you know, Health and Human Services, the administration of the hospital, advocacy groups, nobody would help me advocate for my patient. And so I put that video out, you know, naively thinking the authorities would charge in and help save the patients. And so that's how most people know me, unfortunately. And my nursing background is I have been a nurse for a little over 10 years now. I think I'm pushing on 11 years. My background is actually critical care, ICU, and flight. And I've always been a home health nurse because what most people don't realize is there actually are ventilators in the home health setting too, as well as like complex medications and things like that, IV infusions, extensive wound care. So I've always been a home health nurse because I've always loved like that type of nursing. But I've been a flight nurse and I've been a critical care nurse for at least 8 years out of the 10 of my nursing career. And what most people don't know is I do actually have a previous degree in biochemistry that was my life before I became a nurse. So I'm pretty well versed in a lot of genomics and gene sequencing, as well as some virology, immunology, and population ecology. This isn't my first outbreak that I've dealt with either as a nurse or as a biochemist. I've dealt with measles and dengue, and even when Ebola happened, I've dealt with cholera and things like that. So that's kind of like my little spiel.
Excellent. Thank you. Alex?
Hi, so I'm Alex Flett. I'm a registered nurse coming from Massachusetts. I am also a second career RN. So I have a prior degree in business management and was accounting, and then went back to get a second bachelor's degree in nursing. And my focus with that has been mainly adult medical surgical orthopedic oncology in the hospital setting. And then the last 4 years I spent as a full-time licensed school nurse for all grade levels from preschool to high school. My personal story is where I kind of came about speaking on informed consent and the importance of medical choice, because my son was born very premature and has had a significant health history with brain infection and brain surgeries. And unlike, you know, some people that would think we are just anti-vaxxers, I originally was vaccinating my son and woke up to kind of a holistic side or a need for more informed consent to make medical choices that were so important for his own history. So that's where I speak from it now.
Fantastic. And Erin?
Hi. Thank you so much for having us, by the way. But my name is Erin Olszewski. I'm a registered nurse out of Florida. And I guess prior to becoming a nurse, I was in the military. I served in Iraq for a year and a half when the war first started. So, you know, being on the front lines already, I decided to go back. So I also served in New York in Elmhurst Hospital, the epicenter of the epicenter. And I'm another nurse whistleblower. I also put out an expose and went undercover inside the hospital in order to expose what was going on. So, I'm a mother of three boys. One of my sons is also vaccine injured. So I'm very awake to, you know, things that can happen. That they don't like to talk about either. So.
Sure, thank you. And finally, Catherine.
Hi, my name's Catherine Story. I have been a nurse for 16 years now. I did a lot of critical care in the beginning, some home health, and I actually do some quality reviews. And for the most of last year, I reviewed maybe like 7 to 10 COVID charts a day. And I think it was really interesting for me to see the different that different patients were getting in different parts of the nation, and just all the convoluted treatments and protocols, and so that led me to this group and to share what's really going on out there, so people can be.
Very good. Thank you so much. Well, we've got a superb panel here. It's got some varied backgrounds and some expertise as well as life experience. So I'm looking forward to this. Who would like to provide us with the mission of Global Frontline Nurses? Who would like to tackle that?
I think Erin. Erin brought us together.
So sure. I'm
all right.
Thanks.
I was like waiting on you, Kristen. No. Kind of here, we all are kind of here for the same reason. That's ultimately one, to talk about what everybody isn't talking about inside these hospitals and nursing homes and, you know, these healthcare centers, and kind of exposing the corruption that's been going on for a really, really, really long time. But at this point, it's crimes against humanity, and all of us have experienced, you know, a similar thing happening throughout different facilities. You know, this isn't just hospitals. This isn't just nursing homes. This is everywhere, you know, and even on good days, the hospitals and, you know, just healthcare in general has been really bad. And so, we come from all different places. You know, we're from the US, Kristen and Sarah are from Canada. We have other nurses reaching out from other countries. So we decided to get together, start an organization, call it Global Frontline Nurses, and start moving forward to expose the corruption and also just make changes to the healthcare system. And what better people to do it than nurses, who are the most trusted profession. And without nurses, the establishment can't run anymore. So, I guess, you know, at one point or another, all of us were kind of very alone, and now we're a family, and we're going to run with it. And we're power in numbers. So that's why we're here. We're here to tell everybody the truth, and we're here to save our patients.
Excellent. Excellent. And what has been the response from other healthcare professionals to your movement or to the establishment of your organization? I guess, you know, nurses, doctors, administrators, and so forth.
It's been a mix, I would say. We've had, you know, there's obviously still colleagues that have given a lot of pushback. Like I had a lot of pushback from colleagues I worked with, and there's still a lot out there. But the positive is, since all of us have kind of been speaking out and different points throughout the last 10 months and now coming together, there has been so many more people reaching out. Doctors are reaching out, nurses are coming forward, respiratory therapists, personal support workers. So the voices are starting to come forward, and people are wanting to hear them. People are ready to hear the truth and hear another side. So there's a massive support coming out now.
Yeah, that's good. And I guess it's a scary proposition for somebody to step out of line of what their professional organization is touting or preaching and speaking the truth. So, you know, I commend you for doing that. And obviously, as your organization gains in strength and numbers, more people will feel comfortable to come out and speak their truths. So speaking of that, maybe if we can go around the table here. And if you can provide the listeners with some of your firsthand experiences in your healthcare settings with COVID patients and some of the examples of that, I guess the medical malfeasance that's going on there with these cases. And maybe let's go the reverse direction. We'll start with Catherine.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I had the unique opportunity. I do chart reviews, and I do them remotely to be in a major city on the West Coast when this all started. And then I was in the Midwest, and you know, the hydroxychloroquine has been touted by former President Trump. And it's interesting to me that cities that, you know, that are Democrat were not using it. And then states and cities that are Republican were using it. But what I would, you know, and that just blew my mind. But what I would love to tell people is that I didn't see any patient pass away that was on that medicine. And, you know, where I'm at now, we're doing a lot of other more experimental treatments, and the patients don't have as good of outcomes. And it's very frustrating to watch. I've also, you know, days and weeks and even months where I've had the same amount of patients attempt suicide due to isolation as I've seen COVID. So it's, you know, I found myself just so frustrated and telling people at the grocery store was happening. Anybody that would listen to me. So I appreciate yourself letting us come and share these stories, because people need to know the bigger picture of what's happening.
Absolutely. And that's a shocking revelation that we're seeing, you know, a treatment being drawn upon political lines. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Erin, let's move on to you.
Sure. Okay, so back in March is when everything kind of really went down and they were locking everybody down. So they also kind of stopped, patients stopped coming to my hospital that I was working at in Florida. I worked in the emergency room. We were literally bored, but I found it really ironic because they were still bringing in travel nurses there, even though a lot of nurses were furloughed. So, I mean, that was kind of like, what is going on? Why do we, you know, but they were waiting for this wave that never ended up really happening, at least in Florida. But at the same time, we're looking at New York, like, what is going on? You know, there was like, people were dropping like flies there. So you were looking at it like, oh my gosh. But I ended up going there as a travel nurse. And I was assigned to Elmhurst Hospital after sitting around for 3 days. Some nurses were sitting around for like 3 weeks with nothing to do. So that was kind of another red flag. Like, why do we have nurses sitting around if this is like war? I was like a couple days into the hospital when, you know, I just realized it was literally just a whole lot of just gross negligence, people not caring, just medical neglect. There was patients that hadn't even been touched in 2 weeks. Their IV poles were outside of their rooms. You know, there was feces dried up their backs. I mean, like there was just like, it was just a matter of, I don't know. I can't explain it. I literally felt like I was living in the Twilight Zone. And all I knew is that I didn't want to be a part of that. I couldn't look away, and I knew I had to say something, but the problem was nobody would listen. So we were just told to essentially like hush your mouth or you're going to go home. And I tried as much as I could, but I didn't want to push it too much because I didn't want to go home. One, I wanted to be the one person that could maybe, you know, save at least a patient. And then two, I'm like, you know what? We can't let this happen. Like this can't even, is this America? You know, like I've been in hospitals in Iraq and they were like way better than what was going on. We're not a third world country. So I contacted an attorney. I got some spy glasses and I went undercover and recorded everything that was happening for at least a month. Very scary, but you know, I'd do it all over again, but I'd probably do it better. You know, ultimately I got fired for my social media post. They didn't know I was recording at that time. My expose came out and, you know, here I am fired. I've been fired, blacklisted from nursing. I probably will never, you know, get a job again, which is fine. Because I think we are more effective, on this side of the wall, being able to, you know, recreate an ethical healthcare environment for everybody around the world. So, I guess that's kind of my story in a nutshell. I just felt the need to be able to expose what's going on regardless of the consequences that, you know, I'd face. So I do still have my license.
It sounds more like you're in line for a meritorious service award rather than being fired, Nurse Erin, but I guess I'm not the one making those decisions, unfortunately. All right. Thanks for sharing. Alex, you're next.
So I was working in the school in the, you know, back in March 13 is when they closed the schools down. And I initially had already been feeling like we were not being told enough information about how to positively change our health impacts before COVID came out. It was just kind of like, there's a new virus, everyone needs to wear masks, everyone needs to just remain at home. And there was no positive education around any health benefits, if there's vitamins, if there's nutritional foods we should be focusing on. So I had already kind of thought about that, like, why are we being left in the dark? And ultimately, so prior to COVID, the year prior to this, I've actually been active fighting legislation in our state because there was proposed bills that would remove the right of parents to have exemptions for vaccines for their children to go to school. So I had already been kind of thinking about what this could be leading into. And I think it's, you know, timing wise seems coincidental that there were bills proposed to remove the rights of parents. And then at the same time, we are now adding additional required vaccines for school because this year in Massachusetts, they added 3 additional doses to the school required schedule. So I had thoughts around that. And I also was fired in the spring. So I reached out one of our nurse leaders in a nurse Zoom, the term anti-vaxxer came up and I wrote a professional letter to our nurse leader just saying, you know, we received training on, you know, not to be xenophobic towards Asians in relation to the COVID virus. We should not be using a negative label such as anti-vaxxer when we have children in our schools with valid exemptions. And I never received a response and was let go. So I haven't been working in the schools since the fall season, which to me is a blessing because I actually did choose to homeschool my son this year because I know in our district, they are masking children from preschool up. And I don't always feel fully on board with masking 3-year-olds or 4-year-olds. So those are things that I have, you know, as a mother, as a concerned citizen, you know, looking forward to the future now that we have the COVID vaccine out and the social pressure to, you know, encourage our community members or other people that you don't know their medical history, encouraging them to take a, you know, studied vaccine at this point, I don't think is ethical and everyone needs to make their own decisions. So that to me is the most important thing right now, moving forward, maintaining our, you know, right to medical choice and informed consent with an experimental vaccine.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Thank you. Nicole?
So I was a nurse that went to New York to help with the COVID pandemic. And I was really like, oh my gosh, this is super big. This is the pandemic they've been warning me about, like since like an undergraduate. And when I get there, you know, it was very apparent I was a little bit more comfortable than any of the nurses that I was working with, because when they said that they needed nurses, they didn't specify the type of nurse that they wanted. They just said nurses. And so that brought every type of nurse there, because they didn't realize as nurses, we are specialists in our field, as you can see by our diverse backgrounds. And so I was working with school nurses and OR nurses. I was working with ER nurses, some clinic nurses, things like that. And many of them were not comfortable. They're like, well, what if I have to go into the room? And I'm like, that's kind of our job, is to go into the room and to care for the patient. How did you plan on caring for your patient if you don't go in the room? Well, what if we get sick? And I'm like, what did you think was going to happen when you rushed here? You knew that there wasn't enough PPE, but you came here. I mean, did you just come here for the $10,000 a week? Because we have to save lives. That's why they paid so much, because nobody wanted to come. And so we get there and it's like a hodgepodge mix match of like so many different types of nurses. And in this cluster of trying to get people to NYC to help with this outbreak, they didn't get respiratory therapists. They didn't get the appropriate type of doctors. They didn't get the appropriate type of nurses. All we heard on the news is that they needed nurses and they wanted 30,000 ventilators. They didn't want 30,000 feeding pumps. They didn't want 30,000 ICU nurses. They didn't get thousands of, you know, critical care doctors. I was taking orders from an optometrist, a podiatrist, and a dentist. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, I know doctor is behind your name, but we need MD doctors, like, and the right type of MD doctors. And so you get onto the unit and alarms are going off and things are going wrong and nobody knows what to do. I mean, it was like treading water the entire time. And they let student nurses be full-fledged nurses. They let medical students be full-fledged medical full-fledged doctors. And I'm like, I was taking orders from like a 23-year-old and I'm like, oh no, we don't do that in the ICU. Like, what is your background? I know, you know, maybe he's like a genius and he just like got through medical school very quickly. Oh, well, I'm a third year medical student. And I'm like, excuse me? No. This, we don't like, we need to at least at a minimum have a basic standard of care, which is ARDS protocol. And they weren't even doing that. I mean, they like, sometimes they didn't even know when they were dead. And I was just so appalled at what was happening. And anytime you tried to get somebody off the ventilator, because there were, you know, patients who could have been extubated, who should have survived this, because remember, there was no treatment for COVID. There was just death or a ventilator, which is practically the same thing, we've learned. And so many of us, if you can treat the symptoms, you can, with good quality care, and the research has shown this, that your best defense is a, you know, a very astute nurse. So I got at the first hospital, my little Hispanic lady, I got her ready to be extubated. And I kept pushing and I kept pushing for several days. We need to get her off this vent. We need to get her off this vent. And they didn't want to. And so when I finally pushed and I finally got the doctors to agree to get them off the vent, because the new attending had come on and he's like, yes, like she needed to be extubated a week ago. And I'm like, I have been trying. They switched me abruptly. They didn't want me back. And I'm like, okay. And I was so devastated because she died that night that I didn't show back up. And it wasn't because I was some super great nurse. As I've always professed, I've been rather average. I just happened to be trained properly. She had me as an ICU nurse at night and she had a trauma nurse during the day. And they moved the trauma nurse and then they moved me. And she died because they gave her an inexperienced nurse whose specialty was not dealing with ventilators. And she died. And she was someone who should have lived. I mean, she literally on her medical record came in because the news told her that she had a fever and she should come into the hospital because this was a deadly virus and she could spread it. And it, from the time she walked in that they timed it to the time she was intubated, it was 15 minutes. And all she came in for was a fever because the news told her to come in. Because remember, don't you remember on the news, they were all standing in line to get into the hospital. Dying people don't stand in line, okay? They put them in there and then they intubated them inappropriately because they didn't know how to put the vents in BiPAP. I mean, I said that on my video and Has anybody looked into any of this? We've been saying this, they were wrongfully intubating people. And things like that. Then they sent me to the next hospital. And I was very fortunate that I was on a unit where it was actually nurse anesthetists. And most of them were furloughed, but they had all been critical care nurses prior to this, or we had ICU nurses. So they were living the longest. But the problem is that they were having us hang experimental drugs that were killing the patients anywhere within hours to 72 hours of getting these drugs. And we're like, well, what is this? What are you hanging? They're like, I don't know. They just said that there's no treatment and they're trying this new drug. We're trying to save lives. And I'm like, well, girl, everybody is dying when you get that drug. So stop giving it. And they kept hanging the drug. And then I had another patient who was ready to be extubated. And another patient who was like ready to get off that ventilator, ready to go, COVID resolved, COVID negative times two, several days apart. Vital signs were great. Labs looked great. I'm like, let's get him off this vent. We need to get him off this vent. And then they show up and they're like, hey, this drug's for your patient. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's all he's on is sedation to keep him on that vent because we're weaning him off. He's going to go home. We're going to discharge this man to life. And they're like, oh no, this is an experimental drug. We're gonna see if it's going to help his COVID. I'm like, oh no, he's COVID negative times two. He's going home. We're going to get him off this ventilator. And they're like, no, you need to hang it. And I'm like, no, I don't need to hang it. He has no COVID. So why am I giving this drug? And they're like, well, we'll send you home. I'm like, then send me home because I don't work here. I came to help you. Okay, you needed nurses and I came to help. Like, this isn't my job. And so I was able to stave it off that shift. And then I come back the next shift and I was on night shift and they took that patient away from me. But at that time, I didn't think anything of it because sometimes we have to shuffle around patients. You may not always get the same patients all the time. And then 2 hours into the shift, they moved me. And I got really upset. I'm like, why are you moving me? Because they were taking my two ventilated patients away from me, giving them to two additional nurses. So now they had three ventilator patients each to send me up to what was like the family planning department that got turned into an impromptu ICU. It's like where you go to like get like, I don't know, obstetrical care. Like, I don't quite know all of that stuff. It was just an outpatient clinic and like offices and things. And there it was a non-COVID unit. It was a surgical ICU. And I was going to be like the seventh nurse to four patients. And I sat there for several hours doing nothing. And it was absurd. And I'm like, so you just decreased the quality of care that those other patients on the other unit were getting because you have now forced a nurse to take more patients that is like safely capable to provide safe, competent care. And the research has shown this and put them at higher risk of death and mortality and injury. Because even if they are like skilled and competent, there is a diminishing return on the amount of like good quality care you can give with the sheer amount of patients you have. And for me to sit there and I'm just like, this is ridiculous. This man is going to die. They're going to give him that drug. He doesn't need it. It's been killing people. And that's how that video got made. I was begging for help because I knew that what was going to happen to my last patient was going to happen to him. And it was so sad because at the first hospital, I had the patient that lived the longest at 2 weeks. Doesn't that make you wonder about something? How can two nurses keep one patient alive for 2 weeks when sometimes you go onto that unit and 50% of them would be dead in 12 hours? Nobody asked these questions. Nobody asked any questions. They just kept plugging along. And I'm like, we need to ask questions about what's going on here. Because at that time in New York, they were the only ones that had those death numbers. Even Italy didn't have those death numbers. And even the overcrowded developing countries didn't have those death numbers. And so that's what my experience was in NYC.
And any idea what those experimental drugs were? Did you ever learn what they might be?
I've been trying to research into some of them and do like a reverse search into the clinical trials to see if I could find some of them because they have to have clinical trials started. I mean, per the regulations. And before they've reached like a certain FDA approval step, they only have an alphanumerical code number. And I can't find any of them at this moment. And they weren't repurposed drugs either. These were something that got pulled off a shelf. And remember, COVID at that time in April and May had only been around for 30 to 60 days. I don't know if people realize this, but you can't just whip up a cocktail of a brand new drug out of nowhere in 30 to 60 days. I mean, I'm sure you could, as you have seen with this vaccine, but do you really think it's going to be safe and effective? And that's what they were doing. And I'm like, why are we doing this when there are other drugs on the market? And I'm not even talking HCQ, and I'm not even talking ivermectin. They weren't even giving steroids half the time. They weren't giving antibiotics to deal with secondary infections. They weren't giving anything to that was antiviral. They were giving nothing for temperature because remember, ibuprofen was not to be given. And we found out that was a lie. So they weren't even doing basic standards of care. All medicine went out the window because it was COVID. And that's what we've seen this entire pandemic. No critical.
I'm just going to add, they were hanging just recently in Texas plasma that was experimental, and these patients were dying within 4 to 7 hours, maybe give or take. So that's happening to this day right now.
Mm-hmm. And then along the border with minorities and undocumented, that's who gets that experimental plasma. Yeah. It's very convenient.
The nurses on these floors, that this recently refused to give it because they saw what was happening to their patients. So what they did is now they're having the emergency staff give it to the patients and then sending them up to the floors. So that's pretty disgusting. And that's happening present day. So this is not just like a March, April, May height of the pandemic. This is like a here and now, we need to expose this immediately kind of thing. Because they're literally like murdering these patients, and they know it, and then the staff know it. And so this is what happens when order followers follow bad orders, don't stand up.
Well, the situation is looking worse than I ever imagined it so far. I mean, this is a pretty dramatic information, ladies. Sarah, let's get your input, please.
Yeah, so for me, I work in a nursing home. So for right away from the start, I mean, if you work in a nursing home, you kind of know that the government doesn't really care about these seniors. Here in Ontario, the government gives an allowance of $9 per day for food for each resident compared to prisoners who get almost $15. So right away for me, I was like, well, that's weird. We're shutting down the whole entire economy to protect these people, huge red flag from the start. And then there's the isolation in nursing homes. That's pretty concerning. I mean, you have to think, people go to the nursing home, that's the last stop, and all you have left is your loved ones. That's what keeps them going. And so taking that away is detrimental to their well-being. Obviously, a lot of them are dying of failure to thrive. They give up. And or broken hearts, and they're dying alone. Some of them dying because they're not seeing their loved ones, plus dying alone. So, you know, to me, that's really, you know, nobody has the right to tell us when and where we can see our loved ones, right? And so another big concern was that there's a lot of testing going on in nursing homes. So every 2 weeks, and now I think it's weekly, everybody gets tested. And as we know, the tests are inaccurate. And so there's obviously going to be false positives. And once there's false positives, it's not just that loved ones can't come in. Residents are then locked up in their rooms and can't come out for up to 14 days. And if someone tests positive again, that keeps going. And that's really, really detrimental to them. You can see it after 2 weeks, someone who walks with a walker can no longer walk. There's a lot of falls. There's like, you know, it's really it's really bad for them. And so that was a big trigger for me. And so, you know, I was really not doing well. I also went online and posted and vented in a private group, and someone took a picture, sent it to my employer, and I was terminated also right away. And then I went to my other job and was terminated because we were in Washington. So lost two jobs. But also another concern that's happening now in nursing homes is that, and I've been saying this since March, they're coming up with this vaccine. So now they're vaccinating with this experimental vaccine. You know, they're giving it to residents. And it was said by several doctors now that not to be, you know, don't be alarmed if one or two residents die in nursing homes after a day or two of receiving the vaccine. And I'm like, this is insane. We shut down the whole world to protect these vulnerable people. And now we're going to inject them with something that might kill them to protect them. And so, yeah, that's my story. It's just going crazy. Yeah. And also mental health, obviously. It's been detrimental to everybody, you know, anxiety, depression, overdoses, suicides are skyrocketing. I mean, there's kids now, like, you know, 6, 7, 8 that are suicidal. Like, it's so, yeah, lots of concerns there.
Well, that's certainly, you know, when you speak of the mental health impacts there, I mean, there's some pretty restrictive measures on how prisoners can be treated in terms of isolation. And yet, you know, if you have an elderly person in a home, you know, if they've got a year or two left, 14 days is an incredibly long time, especially if that becomes a 28-day spell where they're isolated. I mean, the hopelessness that will cause or can induce, I mean, it just must be, that's life-altering, isn't it?
Absolutely. And even when they do get to see them, they don't get to touch them. They don't understand. They're wearing masks. They can't touch them. Someone's watching over them to make sure that they're not touching. And if they're touching, then it's, you know, canceled. And it's like, you know, it's really hard to see. It's crimes against humanity.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And Kristen, let's wrap up this segment with you.
Yeah, my background is a little bit different too, coming from the neonatal intensive care unit. As I mentioned, I went back and kind of learned more about holistic health. So I was kind of opening up my eyes to a lot more that I was seeing in the medical system, like iatrogenic diseases, like medical treatment that was causing harm, and especially in our premature babies. So a lot of times we take care of micro-prems, you know, at 23 weeks of age. And at 60 days is usually when a baby will receive their first immunization. And in our unit, it doesn't matter when that baby was born. So if they're 23 weeks at 60 days, they receive the same immunization that a term baby would receive at 60 days. So this 23-weeker is not even full term yet in receiving this, you know, immunization that, you know, a full term baby would receive at 2 months of age. And that is a very significant a difference in age, especially, you know, when they're immunocompromised, you know, they're already going through all these treatments. And I would see this happening so often that the babies, you know, they would be getting better. They'd be kind of in the unit, we call them feeders and growers. Like, they just need to eat and grow and get ready to go home. And they'd be given their immunization and then have to end up back in our critical care unit, back on breathing support. And they'd be having a lot of what we would call spells, apneas, bradycardias. And they, anytime I try and bring this up, it was just considered a normal side effect. And I would get brushed off and it wouldn't be, you know, seen as important, but something obviously was happening. So I've been watching a lot of that. And then with my experience with COVID, they closed off an entire gynecology wing beside us for COVID overflow patients, and it remained empty the entire time. So women that, you know, were needing appointment surgeries or were getting canceled and put on a waiting list and denied, you know, to keep this hallway empty for possible overflow, and it didn't happen. Our respiratory therapists were told that they're going to have to get transferred to the adult ICU. They never left our unit. They never had to get transferred anywhere. We never saw, and we work in a major, or I worked at a major hospital here in the city where I am, and it was never full. And I think very interesting, we've talked about this, us Canadian nurses compared to you know, our fellow Americans, just there's not really the medical incentive, financial incentive, I mean, in Canada. So we haven't really seen a lot of deaths when you look at it, right? If you look at the stats online, I think we've had 17,000 overall deaths of COVID out of our 37 million Canadians, our population. That's like 0.0004% have been affected by this. And so my concern is the restrictions that's happening on the communities and kids, because I work with the babies and the families and children in the community. So that's been my fight. throughout all this. Parents, you know, moms are now being asked to wear a mask while they're in labor. You know, that's traumatizing in itself. Dads are not allowed in the OR rooms when their wives are having a C-section for births. Only one parent allowed at the bedside at a time. You know, and this is a very worrying, traumatic time if you have a baby in the NICU and you don't have any support with you at all. You're alone throughout all this. I know some parents weren't even seeing their children for days, if not weeks on end. If a mother was in the antenatal unit, so high risk and needing to go on to bed rest, they could be there for weeks and months at a time as well. And again, they're only allowed one support person. And so they had to decide like who that one person was going to be. And again, they weren't able to see their children. And just there's a lot of dehumanizing happening, a lot of separation, a lot of isolation. Just, I think, again, adding to the mental health issues when you don't have the proper support needed to get through these trying times, it's devastating. And it not only affects the parents, but it does have an effect on their, you know, baby that they care for, because they pick up on all of that as well. Babies now are being separated from parents too. If there's like a positive test, they're telling moms that they can't breastfeed, or moms need to clean themselves every time they're about to put their baby to breast to feed. And it's just, no, that's not natural. Like, we're not sterile beings. We don't need to clean ourselves before our babies touch us. Like, it's just these things that are happening, it's just not healthy. And I get emails, because I've been working on cases with kids on wearing masks in the school system. And like Alex had mentioned, here in Ontario, it's also grade one and up, where you have to wear a mask throughout school as well as outside. And I'm getting emails from parents, you know, children talking about, Sarah, I think, mentioned as well, suicide. One six-year-old parent was telling me, like, you grab like a parent's credit card and pretended to cut wrists. I don't even know where they're learning this stuff. Sick kids, mental health line, I think, went up by 3 million this year for mental health cases. So there's devastating effects happening in our community. And that's what I also am trying to bring to light, just the effects that these mandates and restrictions are having is not just, you know, on elderly or the people that we're trying to help. It's overall, it's our entire society is being affected.
Absolutely. And I think there's going to be a result here, which we're not really looking at, which is any child that was born maybe from, you know, July, August of 19 through this entire period, some of their formative development in terms of reading facial expressions and interaction is going to be truncated. And that's time that we don't have a model that shows us that we can, or those children will be able to recover that lost time. And certainly that, 0 to 12 months is an extremely formative time in these young people's minds and developments. And, you know, what is that going to translate to 25, 30 years down the road when these people have impaired social function, or, you know, the inability to read someone's facial expressions, or that's those consequences I don't think we've quantified at all yet.
No, absolutely. And just to add quickly, as I'm thinking of this as well, like, we've seen like an increase in autoimmune disease, chronic disease, autism, all these things are increasing throughout the years in our children. But all the measures also that we put in place, we just keep adding more chemicals, and we keep adding more, like, you know, sanitization. I know in our school board here, I've heard from teachers that they're taking out the sinks in the schools to avoid hand washing, because I guess they had touched the taps and it's too much contamination. So now they're promoting only sanitization in the school. So we're also in a lot of our schools and hospitals and workplaces. I know we've started something here in Ontario. I don't know if it's anywhere else, like fogging. We do a lot of fogging every day to sanitize. Again, we're not sterile beings. We're more bacteria than we are human. And I don't even know what this added amount of chemicals are going to also do to, you know, our children, to us. Like, we haven't even put that factored in, like, that they're toxic, they're carcinogens, they're endocrine disruptors, and we just are blasting ourselves with more toxic chemicals instead of what Alex had mentioned too, is preventative care. There has never been a single mention of preventative care or empowerment on how to actually take care of yourself.
Absolutely. And that's a great point with the sanitizers. And in my conversation with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya of Stanford, he agreed that we could be in for a problem in terms of developing some superbugs, whether that's a fungus or bacteria. I mean, with the quantity and variety of these different sanitizer products, the only realistic outcome is that we're going to produce something which is has no means of being able to cope with. And that's nobody's talking about that. Dr. James Lyons Weiler, I think, published something on the quaternary ammonium compounds, which are looking to have reproductive impairment. And, you know, this is, we're finding these products in our schools in terms of surface cleaners as well as hand sanitizer. So that's something that, you know, really has been overlooked in this problem here. So I guess I'm sure everyone has the same thoughts on this, but, you know, a great man once said, the cure cannot be worse than the disease. And then, you know, I guess in your opinions, are these lockdown measures in any way beneficial? I mean, are we doing more harm here than we are good? And let's start with you, Kirsten. We'll go the opposite direction.
Oh, they're absolutely detrimental. There is nothing effective about a lockdown. You know, you're taking people away from loved ones, from connection, you know, breathing fresh air, from, you know, just all the things that make us human, the things that we need, right? We need to interact. We need, you know, our oxytocin hormone, you know, like, you know, through hugging, through laughter, through smiles, and we're even blocking that by hiding our faces. Isolation is lonely. Mental health was a problem before all this. And, you know, as the girls have mentioned, it's just on the rise. There is absolutely nothing beneficial about locking healthy people away and keeping them away from each other. There's nothing. There's no science behind it. And we can see already that there has not been any positive outcome from it.
Sarah?
She just said everything I wanted to say. I don't really know what, there's no benefits. I just, lockdowns, it's been said, like, I think, I forget which doctor said it, but he checked everything out and said they were 10 times more. I think it's much worse, because I've heard, like, there's going to be an excess of 250 million people going into poverty and starvation. Like, if we look at it globally, it's it's ridiculous. And all the measures are so harmful. The mask, yeah. Social distancing, the chemicals, all of it. It's just, it's the opposite of health. It's destruction of health. It's so annoying.
Yeah, it really is. And let's just touch base on that. I mean, the UN has stated that they are anticipating 150 million people not just go hungry, but starve. And that is something that, you know, that should be on the minds of every single person in the world that is participating in this. You know, if you're wearing a mask and you think that these measures are some way productive or positive, you are complicit in the deaths of 150 million people, an agonizing, slow, painful death. And that's something that to me is just unacceptable. I mean, that's ever since I've learned that it haunts me. It's very troubling. Nicole,
The problem with that is that, well, for me, I was very aware of this before. 30,000 kids die every day before COVID of starvation. And, you know, I think when it doesn't affect people, people don't pay attention. So this is how you see how people are very selfish, especially in first world countries, you know, like, I'm wearing my mask to protect you, but really, yeah, right. You know what I mean? Like, it's really, it's disappointing.
You've affixed the label which states that I don't have any original thought in my brain, nor do I have an ounce of critical thinking. That's what the banner that you're wearing by sticking a mask on your face.
Right.
Nicole.
What specifically would you like me to on that topic?
You can simply say, yes, you agree that lockdowns have no positive effect, or if you can think of, or any of these measures. I mean, we're talking face masks, social distancing, the isolation, you know, you can have a short answer or a long answer. That's up to you.
Oh, okay. So in the beginning, I can understand why we did what we did, because this was a new virus. We were trying to protect as many lives as we can. So these were the only things that we had to arm the entire country with in a very short amount of time to try and save lives. But the problem is as time goes on, we should be able to increase our knowledge base and understand more about what is going on and collaborate with other countries and learn from them and make positive decisions for our citizens. The problem is that they have corrupted and abused the science behind all of this so much that no one can tell what they should listen to anymore. And it's that confusion that is causing the mistrust and the misinformation, because sometimes you should listen to doctors, but just not those doctors there. You should listen to scientists, but just not those scientists over there. You can listen to nurses, just not these nurses. And when it comes down to it, science doesn't lie. Science is what science is. It's the data that is there. It is the process that is there. It's how you decide to use that science that is being grossly abused. And so we knew in the beginning that the lockdowns weren't helping. So why would you continue to do something that doesn't work? We knew that the masks were giving people a false sense of security, and they would go out and they were getting sick because of it. And I use this example is like, take your mask and ask a nurse, would you wear this mask to go take care of COVID patients or any healthcare professional? And they're going to tell you, no, I wouldn't wear that mask that, you know, you made on the sewing machine or that surgical mask, because it's not going to protect me from COVID if I go take care of COVID patients. And so we kept saying, wear the mask. And I can't tell you how many times I got patients that are like, I did all the things. I wore the mask and I stayed away and I still got it. And I'm like, because they became the cult of the mask, and it gave people a false sense that they were being protected when they went out to do grocery shopping or whatever they needed to do, because you don't always have the resources to stay home. And then they got sick, but they did what they were told. And we're in this to save lives. We should be informing people and arming them with the best knowledge and the best interventions to save them. Because once you get on that ventilator, we know that you have high mortality rates. So why did we stop people from, like, literally put in legal injunctions to prevent you from getting certain medications? Why did we? That now we realize works. Why aren't the doctors prescribing these medications in the primary care setting? Well, because they'll lose their license if they prescribe it. The pharmacy will lose their license if they fill it. And they've just corrupted the science and abused it so much that nobody knows heads from tails anymore. And that's the part that is just so infuriating. But they want you to take remdesivir, which is thousands of dollars, when you're in the hospital already, and it only improves your survival rate by 30%. Like, I don't know, but if I was a betting person, you know, because I come from Nevada, I wouldn't bet my odds on 30%. Like, it's just ridiculous. And statistically speaking, all of us here, we should have had a loved one die, you know, based off the numbers and the percent probability of mortality. None of us have. You know why? Because we know what works and we know what doesn't work. And they won't tell people that so we could save lives. I mean, has anything that we said here sound completely like off the charts? I mean, we're not telling you to go rub peanut butter on yourself and go align your chakras. We're literally telling you, you know, support and supplement your immune system, get exercise, get out there and get some vitamin D, which now we realize 80% of those patients didn't, you know, had low vitamin D levels. You know, be with your family, support your mental health, wear the correct type of mask if you're going to wear a mask. There's early interventions. Please go get early interventions so you don't end up on a ventilator. I mean, take vitamins. I don't feel that saying, like Kristen said, children outside playing is a bizarre idea, or taking a multivitamin is a bizarre idea, or not locking away the old people in solitary confinement is a crazy idea. And so we're not following the science that has always been there and has always directed us. We took all knowledge and threw it out the window, and we're just making it up as we go. And in the meantime, people are dying. People are losing their jobs. People are committing suicide. People are losing their homes. People are going without food. Children are suffering, the elderly, all of it. Everything that we know, you know, the American dream, I'll say, for us Americans, is now disintegrating. All because we don't want to do something to save a life. And I mean, I fight with doctors all the time to get ivermectin. I fight with doctors all the time to get HCQ. They won't do it. But you know what? When I can finally, and here's the thing, they don't trust the science I show them. They don't trust the peer-reviewed articles I send them. They just want to get rid of me because I became so annoying that they gave the drug. And you know what? If I got to be annoying to save a life, I'm going to be annoying to save a life. And you know what? 72 hours, negative COVID, off the COVID unit. I mean, I'm not a genius, I'm just average. I just happen to know that the science works and it was created by these specialist doctors. But they don't want to give it. And I just don't understand why the corruption of the science and why all of a sudden now 22,000 people can go to the Super Bowl, but you couldn't have Thanksgiving dinner. You know, 22,000 people can go to the Super Bowl in a stadium, which should be a super spreader event, but you couldn't have Christmas and you couldn't go see your loved ones in the hospital before, like, why they died. And our children can't go to school and they can't go to playgrounds. I mean, you lost your home for what? So these people can go to a Super Bowl? Well, I guess maybe because it's $14,000 per ticket, maybe that's a valid reason as to why COVID won't be at that stadium, but they'll be at your church and your school and your Christmas dinner. And I think we just need to get back to common sense, because common sense seemed to keep us alive.
Interesting on that point too. I mean, of course, you can attend a Black Lives Matter riot or an Antifa riot, and that's okay. But you can't go to church on Sunday because somehow that's you're gonna spread the disease, right? It doesn't make any sense. Alex, you're up next.
So I can agree with everything that's been said before. I was gonna point out, just like Nicole said, I can understand in the beginning why maybe they wanted to do a lockdown to just hold people in place, to limit travel between the countries, and then also to just kind of get a game plan in the hospitals if it's a new virus, if they're trying to figure out treatment, and they, you know, wanted to curve it and hopefully, you know, get a game plan. But as we know and have seen, that wasn't what, you know, that was what was told to us as the reason for it. And it's just kind of been extended. I know Canada, like right now, I have friends in Canada, they're in full lockdown. They're, you know, receiving tickets for someone dropping off their children at a grandparent so they can go food shopping. I mean, that's insane. Here in Massachusetts, we've had, you know, limits on restaurants have to close at a certain time. So like past 9:30, you know, so why does it change from an hour to the next hour? You know, it's just interesting. Like you said, churches are being closed, but Walmart has remained open. Also just kind of with the lockdowns and kind of, like we said, the closures of school, there was an article that came out in JAMA in November, I believe, that estimated the loss of, you know, estimated life expectancy. And it was like 5.5 million lives are expected to be lost in the sense of shortened lifespan of our public school age children. I don't agree, and I don't understand with, you know, the continuation of lockdowns when we obviously know that that's, you know, that's not beneficial. And then even to kind of not to like play countries against each other, but I have family in Sweden, and it's interesting to just kind of see what other countries have chosen to do. And with the idea of natural herd immunity, or, you know, kind of getting into that talk where the World Health Organization recently changed the definition of herd immunity to only include vaccination. But that's an interesting thing too, because as they've said, as we learn, you know, once we've learned, say it's 99% of people are gonna recover from COVID, Can we expect exposure for some of our younger population, or people who, not that they feel that they can combat this illness if they get it, but does it make sense to kind of let some movement around with other people to kind of build antibodies in a healthy population of people? I know there's been kind of talk about even children kind of being like a stop block, like not transmitting it. So is the, you know, closures of schools necessary? Should playgrounds be closed? I think there's a lot of information there that hasn't been discussed and shared with the public, and it's been just kind of remain with masks. And for me, like Nicole said, it as kind of like a physical barrier, the illusion of public health protection, whereas like we're just kind of waiting, everyone's been led along to wait for this vaccine to come. So I think there's a lot of mindset in that too, with, you know, we can resume normal, or I can take this mask off eventually, you know, when I finally get the vaccine. And I think there's just a lot of, that's misleading. I think it's misleading that we've been kind of
led along this path, and that's you know, what they're kind of holding everybody out for.
Well, and of course, now most recently we've heard that the vaccine may not offer that panacea that was originally promised in terms of, you know, you possibly can still transmit the virus, you still have to wear a mask. And so, you know, why would anyone on earth subject themselves to be part of an experimental drug program? That's a little shocking. And Aaron, anything in the anchor position there to conclude this subject?
No to lockdowns. Okay, no, but honestly, you know, what they're doing is they're turning people against each other. You know, and this is not by chance. This is definitely by plan. And it's working. And that's really, really terrifying. And the biggest thing is that I think a lot of people know that everything that's going on, especially now, I mean, we're in January 2021. Look at how wishy-washy this the WHO has been, or the CDC. I mean, they're all like, yes, do this. Never mind, we were wrong, do this. Never, like, how do people still trust what they're listening to? You know, and that's so scary that so many people are just complying. At the end of the day, what we need to do is stop complying. It's really, really easy. And that's why I'm like, for us to be together, you know, it is power in numbers. And I don't think that people realize how powerful, like, they are just as an individual to just stop complying. You know, there's no data or science behind masks. What they're doing is they have a mask, so people are easily, you can easily distinguish who's not following the orders. So then you have, you know, a mob mentality attacking these people. I haven't worn a mask in Florida since I've gotten back. And guess what? I have not gotten COVID. My kids have not gotten COVID. You know, like, we are meant to be around bacteria and viruses. I mean, that is what builds our immune system. They're making us fear things that we live around every single day that make up our world, that make up our bodies. It, you know, like, that fear is really what's creating the real pandemic here. And so to be locking people down in their homes, and then, you know, most of these people are searching for answers, right? They're looking to the news. We can't trust a thing on there. And the problem is they're intimidating people like us. They're intimidating, you know, the doctors speaking out, and, you know, they're scrutinizing everybody and calling us crazy, firing us from our jobs. And so anyone that may be on the edge watching this, ask yourselves, why would they hush perspectives from people that were actually there, that actually worked in COVID units, are seeing it, have been trained. We're highly educated women. And so ask yourselves, why would they want to hush people like us up if we didn't have some sort of truth on our side? Why would they want to intimidate us? Why would they want to go after our jobs, after our license? There's some horrible hit pieces, you know, that, I mean, we've all been a victim of. They're calling us domestic terrorists at this point. But you know what? That's part of that fear. You know, they want people to be fearful of the truth. So, I mean, I always say at this point, like, all of us here, we don't have anything else to lose. And that should be terrifying to them.
Well, and that's something, you know, along those same lines, if somebody's sitting on the fence, are you more willing to listen to somebody like Dr. Fauci that owns 50% of the Moderna vaccine and stands to make hundreds of millions of dollars personally, or, you know, ladies like yourself who are in the nursing profession, who are risking their livelihood, risking their credentials to say something which goes against the narrative? I mean, to me, that's an easy decision. And it should be for most people. You know, here are some courageous women that are speaking their truths with only downside other than their personal, you know, to maintain their personal integrity. And so why would you listen to a talking head who's a paid shill for, you know, either their personal benefit or their you know, their supporters or their sponsors? It's just, that to me is mind-blowing. I don't understand how people have just have this gap in critical thinking.
Or people like Bill Gates, who's neither a doctor or a scientist. But I mean, look at Follow the Money. It's been like this for a long time. I mean, I looked into vaccines like years ago and I didn't know either. You know, my son was severely injured. And when I figured that out, I was like, well, darn it. Like, I want my money back from nursing school because I feel really duped.
Sure.
Mind you, I'm still paying my student loans and can't get a job at this point, but you know, that's neither here nor there. But I mean, you know, like they have lied for a really long time. And honestly, I feel like in a way, I think that this whole COVID pandemic has been a blessing in disguise because it has exposed a whole lot of corruption that has been going on for a really long time. And now people are finally starting to like dig a little bit more into it, especially now that they're like trying to shove this experimental biologic that they're calling a vaccine onto the population for a survival rate of 99.9% for the majority of the population. No. I'm sorry, yeah. But I mean, no. That is, that should be a red flag for even the most, you know, pro-vax person, you know, on the planet. You know, just look into it, can't hurt you.
For sure, for sure. And Catherine, looks like you're on the way to the airport there in a car. You have anything to add to this?
I do, thank you. I have to jump off after this, so.
For sure. Really,
what Aaron said, just about the powerlessness, I think the whole mandate where we are taught to think that somebody else has to do something in order for us to be healthy is illogical. And then it puts us in a victim position. And, you know, I've had experience, my son was actually vaccine injured as well. And it could have been, if him getting a virus at that point in time was really, really dangerous for him. But I didn't go around making other people change their lives and their worlds. I was forced to, you know, read more, to reach out to people, to research, and to figure out how to heal his gut, to figure out how to build his immune system, to figure out what true health was. And that's empowering. So that's the ultimate frustration for me with the mandate is we're teaching people that, you know, in order for you to be healthy, somebody else has to do something. And that's just a lie. You know, if you want to be healthy, take that on and, you know, build up your immune system, learn what true health looks like, and you're golden. You don't need anybody else.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. I think that's a very good point, is that this has really revealed to, or should reveal to many people, that you are in charge of your own health and that you can't externalize your healthcare or your body's needs to somebody else. I mean, you ultimately are in charge of your own health. And if you're making poor decisions, and let's face it, most of these diseases that we're faced with in the developed world are lifestyle diseases that you've brought upon yourself or made a poor choice and received a vaccine or multiple vaccines.
Yeah, exactly.
So if we can move on now to the PCR testing, which obviously isn't really a test, you know, how did we get to this point where, you know, we're really relying upon something which has no basis as a diagnostic tool? And then interestingly, with the new administration being sworn in, suddenly the WHO has decided that the cycle rates are too high and we should lower them, which obviously is going to create an end to our case demic. Who would like to touch base on this one?
I can go. I don't know.
Oh, like sure.
This topic.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah. I do find it really fascinating that, you know, it's unfortunate Carrie Mullins, the creator of the PCR test, died last August in 2019. Just kind of seems very bizarre, but but all his teachings have told us, you know, like, and Nicole is quite knowledgeable on this because she actually like has used this test a lot in, like she said, her previous life as a biochemist. But anything over a cycle rate of 25, so you start getting into 26, you're basically flipping a dime. So it's like 50%, you're going to have like false, you know, positives. And then you continue higher than that and higher than that. And I think like where we're at in Canada, and I think it's the same in the States as well. Like we're at a cycle rate of 35 to 40. And at that point, you're looking at 97% false positives. So only 3% of that is accurate. So we're basing everything off of like false positives and creating an entire case demic. And the people that are, you know, testing positive, like they're volunteering to do this. They're healthy, right? They've changed the definition of what asymptomatic means. Asymptomatic used to be like, okay, you know, I use this example just because it's easy. You have low blood pressure, but you know, that's normal for you. You're asymptomatic. We'll just move on and we don't need to look into that. But now asymptomatic all of a sudden means like you're a dangerous threat and a possible carrier. Like that's never been a thing. Asymptomatic is a healthy person, period. Nothing else. And yeah, you know,
I guess that goes along the same lines of all this sort of revisionist science and you know, basically creating it's a new paradigm for infectious disease, which they fabricated to promote their narrative, it really seems like.
Absolutely. And I work with someone that is an expert in the PCR test. And, you know, she like has a test, what they're looking for. And actually, I should probably pass it down to Nicole to talk about this. But basically, you know, they're looking at a sequencing, then amplifying, like, you know, the genetic sequence. And what they're, everything that they're finding in there, you know, is like all coronaviruses, all like flus, RSV, like all these things are kind of lumped into, you know, the same sequence that is now being called, you know, a positive COVID. So that's why, you know, we're not seeing any flu anymore. We're not seeing, you know, kids are not coming in with RSV. We're not seeing any of this stuff. And actually they stopped testing for it, 'cause I've had nurses contact me a lot from different ERs and ICUs, and they got rid of all their flu tests. They're not even testing or swabbing for it anymore.
Well, and of course, those PCR tests in quotations aren't really testing for the COVID virus, because we've never identified, isolated, or purified it. So we're simply looking at a number of known spike proteins, which are in the coronavirus family. And therefore, I mean, number one, you could have been exposed to corona or the COVID-19 virus. Your immune system did its work properly, broke that particle down, and now you have some residue in your nose, you know, or it could be any number of things in there. And yes, now suddenly you're adding to the case numbers. Nicole, did you have anything to add there?
Yes, well, you'll see that the research has shown the reason that children are spared from the negative effects of COVID is because they've crossed immunity to traditional COVID viruses. And so it's just a little ridiculous, because when they decide to do the tests, they don't do an ELISA. They don't, like, for the correct antibody. When it's an antibody, it's like, it's a corona. It's non-specific. I'm like, you need to run an ELISA on that. And they're like, oh, that's too expensive. And I'm like, well, you can't half choose the science. Like, only the science is applicable at this moment because it's convenient. And then once again, back to the PCR test, is that it was never used to be diagnostic. They knew, I mean, even from teachings as an undergraduate, you never go beyond the cycle threshold of 10, because it calls into question integrity of the data, because we know that past that, it's an exponential increase in false positives for whatever piece of sequencing you're using. So to sequence it to 35, sometimes 100, well, of course you're going to find something. It's non-specific at that point, especially with your 3', 5' sticky ends. It's all just kind of lumping together in there once you're at that many cycles. And it's just, and we all knew this, and all the scientists are like, hey, you shouldn't do this. And they continue to do it. And they're making, you know, executive decisions on all the different governmental levels based off erroneous data that is negatively affecting the lives of people. And it is causing deaths. And I just don't understand why you would want to lie. I mean, I guess I could understand why they'd want to lie, but we're in the job of saving lives, and we want to see people live. And so, like Aaron said, follow the money. Who has what to gain from this? Because you know what, if we're still standing up and we're still talking about this and we've lost everything, maybe we're the ones that you should probably listen to, because we're not gaining everything, we're losing everything, and we're still here telling you what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So according to your educated opinion, then, did we ever reach a true pandemic status with this virus? Or are we truly in a casedemic?
I would say
One at a time. Like, somebody go
first. Go ahead.
Well, this would really be Catherine's like specialty right here, is we would need a retroactive chart review of all of these things to see exactly what these people died of. And you can see it in the records, like exactly. It's like they coded after this medication was given. They went into asystole because of this. You can see it inside the medical record. And what they really need to do is they need to retroactively go back into those records and do some type of an analysis to see, and then cross-reference that with the positive cases and cross-reference it once again with the PCR threshold that they were using and extrapolate a correct number. However, that would be intelligent, but they don't want to do that. They just want to be like, oh, we're just going to lower the threshold. And I remember telling Kristen this like last week before the WHO even announced the cycle threshold. I'm like, watch, in a month, they're going to come out with a new test that's apparently more accurate. I mean, I thought they wouldn't be that sloppy and just lower the cycle threshold. I thought they'd at least, you know, recreate a whole new test that would be accurate. No, they literally thought people were that ignorant that they could just lower the threshold and nobody would notice, and all of a sudden COVID disappears. And we haven't even had the third wave yet, and we haven't even reached like true regression to the mean for the first, you know, variant of COVID. And now they're going to open everything up, and now there's early intervention, and we're just going to go about our lives, but we're still going to keep the schools closed, and we're still going to keep churches closed, and you still can't go out and do X, Y, and Z, but we can have the Super Bowl, and we can, you know, celebrities can still have their yacht parties, and you can still go to the Saturday Night Live, you know, New York ball drop or whatever. So really, the science only applies to certain socioeconomic statuses. That's really what it comes down to. And those are the ones that are suffering because, you know, statistically speaking, the higher socioeconomic status people, they should have had a lot of deaths, and they haven't. They're also not lining up to get this vaccine because remember, in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there weren't enough tests, not even enough tests to test the nurses to make sure they weren't transmitting it to the patients. But people with money and, you know, power were able to get COVID tests, but not the nurses. And now all of a sudden, they're all just graciously stepping aside to let the nurses go first. That's not how scarcity and supply and demand work. So really, it's just, you can't pick and choose when the science works and when it's applicable. It either always works or it never works. And that's the frustrating part, is the abuse of the science.
Absolutely. And Kristen and Sarah, I've spoken with a number of people in Canada, and it looks like the official cycle rates are not something that the government is willing to publish. Have you found an official or heard the official number of what our cycle rates are?
I know in London we're about 35, because I know someone there, a counselor's trying to regulate the labs here to try and get more accurate results. So I know here it's high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, I guess Kristen and Sarah, I read an interesting article by the Communist Broadcasting Corp here in Canada that accused you of making unsubstantiated conspiratorial claims about COVID fraud and the hospital's role in misrepresenting the coronavirus pandemic. And it was interesting to see the comments to those stories, where, you know, I scrolled through a couple pages and I found very, I mean, maybe they're being edited out, but there's a lot of attack there from people, you know, which is obviously, it must be somewhat hurtful to you. What are your thoughts there? And, you know, what sort of response are you seeing within your communities to your actions?
Do you want to go, Sarah? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think at first it was kind of scary. There was a lot of attacks and threats. Like, I even got a few death threats. And it was like, if I find your house, you know, if I can find your address, and I, you know, you get scared. You're like, ooh, can people find my address? You know, why can't they find my address? So it was kind of scary at first. But within a few days, not even, I think the day after, you know, after cleaning up all the trolls, you know, and it kind of slowed down, and there was like a wave of supporters that came. So, I mean, at first it was kind of really scary. We had the RCMP show up at our door.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, you know, they did call us domestic terrorists. There was a lot of comments like that, and how, you know, we shouldn't be Canadians, and, you know, definitely not nurses, and lose your license. There was a lot of that stuff.
Garbage.
But like I said, it was, you know, any advertisement is good advertisement because it advertised this. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, there were saying, like, Kristen was talking about vitamins, and, you know, I was talking about like isolation being wrong, you know, like it was like ridiculous. But yeah, a little bit scary, but now, I mean, everything is back to normal, and we're still very strong. I mean, we had our first press conference that we recorded this week. So we're really excited about that. And let's see, maybe they'll like to put us on the news again.
Sure. I mean, I think the more news coverage that you two and the rest of your organization receives, the better it is for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, Kristen, anything to add there? And I guess, you know, I think you were going to chime in there on, you know, whether Canada ever actually reached a pandemic. Maybe just touch base on those two.
Oh yeah, we are never in a pandemic. The numbers are there. Like it's pretty obvious. And all you have to do is go to Stats Canada. Look at this year, look at, you know, the previous years, especially 2018, even 2017, it was a lot worse then. You know, like do a stats comparison, look at all cause mortality. The numbers are there, and we have never been in a pandemic, definitely never been in anything that requires shutting down the entire country, you know, with the world. Like this is just outrageous, right? So Sarah and I are kind of on the same page of why they're doing that, but we've never been in a pandemic, and the numbers are there. But as Sarah said, like it was kind of a heavy couple days at first, like, you know, all the negativity. But once that, like she said, we kind of cleaned up all the trolls and kind of got rid of all this, it was like then the next wave came in of the support, and even like just like huge support from nurses, from healthcare professionals, and from doctors. And, you know, now we're continuing to build our army, and it's awesome. And, you know, like Sarah mentioned, we just recorded our first press release on Saturday. That's going to be coming out mid to late week. And I just know that's going to be the first of May to get the ball rolling and get, you know, hear more stories like ours of more people wanting to speak up. And I know a lot want to do more, but they're terrified of, you know, their jobs. You know, they've seen what happened to Sarah and I. They're scared of their license, and we understand that. But I mean, if enough of us stand up and enough of us are saying the same thing, they just can't get rid of all of us. It's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. And Sarah's been working really hard to help Canadians protect our license. So she's put together a petition that she wants to bring into law, because in the States they have a False Claims Act where their professional nursing license are protected, whereas in Canada we're not, at least definitely not in Ontario. So Sarah's been working really hard to bring that to the table to help nurses be protected, you know, to be advocates. And that's what we're supposed to be. You know, we found our old, someone brought an old Fundamentals of Nursing Canadian textbook, and you know, there's a whole paragraph about being nurse agitators and nurse advocates, and you have to speak up when you're witnessing harm. And that's what we're doing. We're just being advocates. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And so is there a requirement here in Canada to maybe redraft some of the whistleblower policies?
Yeah, we definitely need to redraft. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, they all need to be drafted. Yeah. Because there's no protection for us right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so how would you agree that mainstream medicine, and really highlighted with the coronavirus response, has become more of a faith and belief-based practice rather than one backed by empirical data and unbiased scientific evidence?
Oh, 100%. Especially when I went back to school and I kind of like, you know, the last 7 years and learned more about holistic health. I mean, like Sarah experienced it firsthand, just, you know, the difference of, you know, going through allopathic and medical treatment versus, you know, actual true healing and all the work that she did. And I've done extensive research going back to the history of disease and, you know, Louis Pasteur versus Antoine Bechamp, you know, germ theory and terrain theory, and just learning about, you know, when the medical system and industry actually came into place, right? Like that was over 100 years ago, and it's all been based on a lie to sell petrochemicals. And even like over the past 100 years, it's all been about making money. And if you go back and look at Louis Pasteur's notes on germ theory, he even states in his journals that he made up his like tests and results, and he lied. And on his deathbed, he said germ theory is nothing, the terrain is everything. And we're still pushing false science and the wrong theory. And, you know, this has never been proven. And here we are over 100 years later, And it's time for change. We need to, this is why we're standing up, because we're at a pivotal point where now we can actually change the trajectory for the next 100 years and get back to health, get back to, you know, connection to nature, to well-being, to mindset, to exercise, to, you know, even they've cut off a spiritual connection from all of us for a reason. I mean, if you go back and study anything from Rudolf Steiner, he said that back in 1914, that they're going to come out with a vaccine that they will be able to produce that will cut off like spiritual connection.
Sure. Things. And I agree. I mean, I think this is the positive which could come out of this is that the impetus for a paradigm shift, where enough people get angry at the bullshit that we've been told over these, you know, last 100 years. And, you know, look, we're experiencing a health epidemic in North America and Europe, very much the same. And chatting with Greg Glazer a few weeks back and the landmark control group study, you know, when you compare the health outcomes pre and post early 80s, where the vaccine schedule was ramped up, and then you look at the data that they've collected, I mean, there's a smoking gun here. And with the pharmaceutical industry's get out of jail free card with their zero liability for these biologics and the vaccines that they're administering, it's a beautiful, I mean, it's a completely unethical business model, but it's, you know, you have to give them some level of credit for this sinister plot that they've put together. You know, we require through our lobbyists that you take these substances, which make you sick, and then we sell you a series of more drugs and services to offset those conditions. I mean, it's a brilliant business model. It's diabolical, but you know, and that has to change. And I would like just to touch on what you said about the connection to the divine. And this has been something that has been becoming a bit of there's a thread here that I think that humanity, particularly the Western world, for some reason has moved away from our connection to the divine and nature and that sort of holistic aspect. And if we bring that back within ourselves more fully, I think that's also going to give us a tremendous amount of strength, because that's really what, you know, the masses at this point need is some strength, some connection. When we realize that we're all in this together, and it's not that we stand united by covering our face with a mask, we need to educate ourselves. We need to really become in touch with one another. And that's how we're going to escape from the clutches of the pharmaceutical cartel.
Mm-hmm. That we are, like, we're all energy beings, like we're, you know, electrical, we're energy, and we all are interconnected through this, like the energy that we share, and through, you know, just the way, like, just, I don't know, sorry, trees talk to each other. I get into the whole holistic stuff and the plants, but I mean, trees communicate, they communicate through the roots underground, like the mycelium, like it's amazing. Like if one tree needs or a plant needs like more nutrients, like it, you know, sends it through this mycelium through the ground, this amazing like fibrous connection. I mean, we're no different. We're all like kind of created through all this amazing interconnectedness. And once we kind of still realized the power that we all have and raising our energy and vibrations, it's, I don't know, it's quite powerful.
So I see a big smile on Sarah's face.
I love hearing her talk. She's so like into it. She's so passionate. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm not really good at communicating like she is. Like, I'm more like, I get nervous, I get stuck or whatever. So I just love hearing her. I'm like, yeah. You know? Yeah,
that's great. Well,
I'm totally with her. Like, I had fibromyalgia, and it took them 2 years to diagnose me. Like, they had no idea what I had. Like, I was falling apart. My joints, I was so stiff. Like, I couldn't, one day I woke up, I couldn't move anymore. Like, I had, I had problems with my stomach, my skin. I felt like I had bugs all the time. I couldn't sleep. I had pain. Like, my nerves were shooting. Like, and it was getting more and more painful. And it became like, at some point I couldn't even like lift my arm. I was so tired, and I was in bed for 2 weeks. And, I found out myself, like I did some research, and I found out that, oh, this seems to be like a fibromyalgia. And so I started reading on that, and I was like, you need to send me to a neurologist. And that's when they diagnosed me. But then after that, they were like, we're going to give you these pills. And I was like, those pills? I was like, you know, I was like, and they tell you it's like a long-term disability. And so I was like supposed to be getting worse and worse. And I was like, you know what? I'm not taking those pills, because I know those pills. You get used to them, and they have to increase the dose. And at some point they can't increase the dose anymore, and you're in so much pain. And that's it. You're just going down that path. And I just took charge, and I realized that I had like a lot of trauma. So I had a lot of healing work to do. And as I did that, I started like, you know, I reconnected with my inner child, and, you know, I discovered myself. I started, there was like self-forgiveness that came in, and then self-love. And so I was able to like start eating better, start taking like great supplements, working out all the time, and making sure I had that support for my mental health, and, you know, being around people that understood what I was going through and everything. I have no more fibromyalgia. Nothing. Okay. You. So, and it's crazy because I'm meeting a lot of people that have mental health issues like me, like complex post-traumatic stress disorder, that also have fibromyalgia and that are on a lot of pills. And it's like, no, you don't do it like this. So for me, that's how I realized also, like, the medical industry, the more I look at it, like and I took all my vaccines too. I got all my kids vaccinated. I was taking the flu shot every year until 2 years ago, until I realized like these are toxins and I'm trying to get toxins out of me to get rid of my fibromyalgia. But I mean, I was never an anti-vaxxer, but looking into it now, it's like, oh, I'm not the way they're making vaccines now. I wouldn't even call them vaccines, really. I would not ever take them again, ever. But I'm not an anti-vaxxer. If it was a safe, you know, if there was an actual safe vaccine that was necessary, you know, but yeah.
So I get that. That's a nice transition into the question I have here for you is, you know, since this has started, the official narrative has been, you know, life doesn't get back to normal until the magic vaccine is released. And, you know, I guess, you know, question would be, you know, A, do you support this notion? And, you know, in your opinion, are vaccines safe and effective?
Well, I think I answered that for my part. And I'm like, no, we don't need a vaccine. The survival rate is 99.9%. Like, and old people, I mean, I think people, like, it's so weird because working in a nursing home, we know like 30% of people of old age die from pneumonia. And it's not because they're dying of pneumonia. It's that, or the flu. It's that, you know, it's time for them to go and they need that little push to transition. You know what I mean? So, I'm this vaccine has been scary. I was like, they're going to bring up a vaccine. I've been saying this since March, and it's like, it's here now. And it's like, no, we don't need it. And we don't want it. It's experimental. The animal trials, they skipped the animal trials. And every time they worked on a COVID vaccine since like 2002, when it gets to the animal trials, the animals are fine until they get sick. And then it gets so sick that they die. Yeah. And so they skip that trial and they're giving us the vaccine. I'm totally against it. Yeah. For now, the way it is, like the way it's put out now, no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kristen?
No, the more I've looked in, because I started with food, and that's where my kind of journey into all this started, was, you know, learning about like what we're actually putting into our body. Is it going to nourish us, nurture us, or is it going to harm us? And when you start looking into all like processed foods, you know, like the pesticides and chemicals, preservatives, all the artificial flavor, or just everything, right, that we're putting into our body. And then when you start learning about those ingredients and the effect of us, and then you go look at the actual ingredients in a vaccine, why would I inject that into my body if I'm not willing to consume it? It was kind of like the first thing looking at that. And then once I studied more about the terrain, like one of the simplest pictures that I can come up with, if you think about what germ theory is, so you have a fish. This is a simple picture. You can Google, it's there when you learn germ theory and terrain. So you have a fish and he's swimming in this really dirty fishbowl. And the cure, what they say is like, oh my gosh, like that fish is getting sick. We need to vaccinate that fish. You look at the terrain, you know, it's like, well, why don't we just clean the water? Sure. And so for me, and especially more when I looked back on what actual like viruses are, and, you know, studying the exosomes and getting into all that stuff. But I think we need to do more preventative stuff first. I think we need to look at food. I think we need to look at our mindset. I think we need to look at exercise. Just even the society that we live in, we're in such a hustle bustle, you know, we're always in sympathetic nervous system, right? Like fight or flight, like our cortisol levels are skyrocketing. No one's sleeping. Plus the drinking that people, you know, do after end of work or whatever, just all these things we're doing to our body. We need to first look at our lifestyles before we start injecting ourselves with something to protect us. And Catherine talks a lot about this too, is we need to start getting back into how we can empower ourselves, because we've been told over the last 100 years, and it's been conditioned into us, that our bodies are weak, Our bodies are not good enough. Our bodies cannot handle what's out there in the world. You can't handle your own body. You don't know how to take care of yourself. You need outside help. So we're supposed to put our responsibility in someone else's hand. And they've turned us into a society of victims, right? And so we need to get back into having like being sovereign beings where we're empowered. We know how to take care of ourselves. We can listen to our intuition. We can listen to our gut, and we can actually take care of ourselves and our children. Because I'm not responsible for anyone's health. I'm not putting on a mask to be responsible for anyone. I'm responsible for me. And you know, just like everyone else is responsible for themselves.
So what would you, if you have a few health tips for the average person to sort of, you know, if they're in this rut, they've been, you know, stuck in the lockdowns and they're maybe fed up with listening to what the government's advice is, and what are some steps that they can take into their own hands to have a positive outcome?
Turn off the news. No, but for real though, the news is negative. And even if you don't realize it, it is having a negative effect on your being, on you know, your mental state and everything. It's like, you know, increasing anxiety, increasing stress, increasing your cortisol, increasing all these things. Like that's what the news is. It's all negative, negative, negative. Like it's like perverse. They don't teach you anything positive. Nothing you're hearing is good. Doesn't make you feel good. So turn off the news for real, you know, like read a positive book, do some deep breathing, do some, you know, listen to some music. That would be number one. And then two, simple, eat food that's touched by the sun. I think it's pretty easy. Like eat food that has been touched by the sun, you know, instead of something, you know, that comes from a box or an industry or like a factory or whatever. So turn off the news, eat food that's been touched by the sun, and go out and get out into nature, go walking, go running, do whatever, go, you know, be around trees and plants and breathe fresh air. There's a lot more you can do, but I feel those are pretty simple.
those are the three most important ones. And yeah. All right, excellent. And anything to add to those ones, Sarah?
I'm the same as her. I obviously move, exercise too, but I think the biggest one is that we can't forget to breathe. And it's ironic because they're putting us in masks so that we can't breathe properly the oxygen that we need. But when we're in survival mode and we're in fear like we are right now, I know all my life, when I started doing my healing work, I realized, oh my God, I don't breathe. I hold my breath. And that's really negative too. And I think that we need to calm down because we need to get out of that survival mode and go back into our critical thinking mode. And so I think a lot of breathing and grounding, and really like when you're stressed, like we have to be more conscious of what's happening inside of us, because when we're stressed out, we're not thinking properly. So people need to really take the time to see what's happening inside of me and why. And so when you do that and take deep breaths and ground yourself, you can think more clearly. And I think if we could just calm down and think more clearly together, you know, we can get out of this, because it doesn't make sense. It's just because we're in that survival fear mode that you can't see how it doesn't make sense because you're so scared of dying. So breathing. Breathing, breathing. That's a big one. I mean, and also like, you know, when you're stressed too, you armor your muscles, and that's really tiring too. So we need to learn to relax and, you know, really take in the moment and be mindful of what's happening within us, and so that we can make it better outside of us.
That's well said. Excellent. And so what does the average Canadian need to do, you know, more or less immediately to help everyone get out of this?
Stop complying. Yeah. Like right away, just stop, take the masks off, open your business. Don't social distance, hug everyone, spread love. Oh my God. Like we keep reminding people like these mandates are illegal. They go against our Charter of Rights. They do not hold in court. The police officers are going against their oath. And so we need to have a little bit more of a backbone. Like I said, I don't wear no mask too. I go outside, I don't wear a mask. I'll be the only one not wearing a mask. And I'm very, very proud of it. And, you know, there are a few times where people will take off their masks because they'll be like, well, she's not wearing a mask. And, you know, that's the whole point. We want to make people. So the more people that will break that trend or curse, or it's like almost like a ritual, you know, we need to like get them off. And that's all we need to do. I mean, if we could just stop doing what they're asking us to do and start living again, we can be back to normal tomorrow. And I'm just like, I can't wait. Please, people, please. I mean, but everyone is suffering, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Kristen?
Yeah, that's what I always say too. Just by complying, you're giving consent, and I don't consent. So don't comply to these illegal, unlawful mandates. And another thing you can do, there are some politicians speaking up. So wherever you are, like start emailing and writing letters to your MPs or people in power, start writing, especially to the MPs, because there's more and more MPs that are speaking up and trying to start movements. I know it's happening in Ontario. So I'm sure it's happening in other, you know, provinces or other places, but start writing some letters and being vocal as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure that we've had much activity in that realm out west here, but I know like Randy Hillier and Roman Babber out your way are now breaking ranks and speaking the truth, which is great.
Yeah.
Well, that's we have some great material we've covered here, nurses. I really respect your courage and your bravery. And as we sort of concluded here, you know, we are the majority, and the governments are, you know, probably less than 1% in terms of the authorities. And as you said, Sarah, you know, if people start opening their businesses en masse, there's not enough bylaw officers to ticket people. There has to be this affirmative action of people resisting these measures and pushing back. Otherwise, the measures will continue to get more and more severe and people's health outcomes will just get worse and worse. And for the sake of all the children out there, you know, the adults need to be going to battle on this one for those who can't.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, and wish you all the best in your endeavors here. If listeners would like to learn more about your organization, where would I direct them?
I can go to, there's two now. So we have the Global Frontline Nurses, which was all of us that you met. So www.globalfrontlinenurses.com. And that is a pretty awesome website that's being created. We now have like a backdoor for nurses. There's like a forum, there's a place where, you know, you can have discussions, comment, leave, like we have a file folder of like, you know, evidence and resources. So that website's growing quite a bit and it's amazing. And then Sarah and I are kind of like, we're calling it the pilot project. We're the Canadian chapter from the Global Frontline Nurses. And we're hoping that more chapters and more places around the world will step up as well. I know like Sweden's coming forward, Australia, Ireland. So that's pretty cool. So we're the Canadian Frontline Nurses. So www.canadianfrontlinenurses.ca. And then you can find us there and subscribe or, you know, send us an email and connect, share your stories, experiences, especially if you're healthcare, want to reach out. We want to hear more stories that we're going to be sharing anonymously to our website as well.
Okay, fantastic. And certainly as David Icke said back in May, you know, when we look back upon this in history, the question will be that your grandchildren's will be asking everyone is, you know, what did you do in the year 2020 to prevent the tyranny? And again, I commend both of you for pushing back and I implore everyone to do the same.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Excellent, ladies. You have a great rest of your day, and we'll stay in touch here as I'd love to cover your victories as we move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We will.
Have a great day. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
Take care. Bye.